The business of culture, the culture of business, markets, policy, media, and technology, creatives, renegades of funk. Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad.
We're trying to exist in this dark little corner of the investing space that's not competing with anyone else. We try to only launch funds that don't exist or that we think we can do much cheaper or better.
What a time to be an investor. The brokerage commission is all but extinct. Ultra low cost index funds and ETFs have opened all corners of global stock and bond markets to John and Jane Q. Main Street. An elite group of tech heavyweights is clocked in terms of trillions in market value. And data, well, it's everywhere, both quality and questionable, split second and constant, for better or for worse. A fine time to bring back investor Meb Faber, that rare bird at the intersection of Wall Street and content, to help us demystify these roaring 2020s. Stay with us. Full Disclosure Podcast to NPR, Spotify, and of course, Apple Podcasts. The link is fulldradio.com. You can follow on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at handle fulldradio. And a shout out to our listeners on WVTF Radio IQ, Virginia's NPR news station. You can DM me to carry Full Disclosure on your air. Joining me from Southern California, investing luminary Meb Faber. He is the co-founder and chief investment officer of Cambria Investment Management. He manages Cambria's ETFs and separate accounts, famously hosts the Meb Faber Show podcast, which has had numerous investing heavyweights on it. He's been authored, he's been quoted in Barron's. Gosh, I've seen you in the Times and the New Yorker. You've had white papers, leather-bound books. Sir, do you tap dance? I understand you surf.
I'm a poor dancer. I'm also a poor surfer. I'm a good skier. I grew up in the mountains of Colorado skiing. That was my go-to. But I'm trying to learn to surf. Come on out. We'll take you up, put you on a board.
And then you're a product of UVA schooling, I understand.
I am. I was an engineer once upon a time and a biotech guy. I graduated during the best bubble of them all, the internet and biotech stock bubble in 2000.
I'm going to grill you on all of that, but I want to get to some investing meaning of life questions with you. What I think is beautiful about, so full disclosure, you know we are a public radio show. We are on the NPR member station in Charlottesville, across Virginia, in other places. For public radio listenership, right, which you might, you bring in a smart money audience. You had Professor French on. You had, Cliff Asness on. It's such a rarefied guest list that you have. My goal is to kind of bridge this for John Q. Investor in a very different time for investors where the commission is largely gone. Things have been de-exoticized. You could buy pretty much any kind of diversification from a itsy bitsy cost ETF. And yet, sir, we're told numerous times, even by the likes of the late Jack Bogle, that just stick with simple, the S&P 500, it's the best you can do. And I've always wanted to buttonhole you and ask you, is it really the best mom and pop can do?
I love one of Jack's best quotes was the famous riff on, don't just stand there, do something. And he flipped it around and it was, don't just do something, stand there. And he was trying to convey the meaning of letting your portfolio compound for very long periods. And you referenced Ken French. I mean, if you talk to people about what long periods mean here in 2024 in this sort of short attention span era, I think it's condensed from years to months to, you know, weeks and days. We have 0-day trading options now. But really, you know, we have an old quote. We say it's better to be Rumpelstiltskins than Nostradamus, meaning you want to have this long perspective. And so you mentioned Ken French. We had him on the podcast.
Of Fama and French, Nobel Prize winning fame. I mean, it's not an easy catch.
Yeah. You know, he had a quote where he's like, it's crazy the inferences people draw from any asset or strategy on 1, 3, 5, or even 10 years. Now, he's an academic, so, you know, he likes to talk about things in the academic sense. But he's like, how long do you think it takes to really tell if an investor has a skill and alpha?
I completely whiffed on that, as did your listeners. 64 years.
Yeah, it's longer than most. And I think it's a little longer than I would say. But it really comes down to, hey, you got to study history, understand the process of what goes into the portfolio. Doesn't have to be complicated. And then you kind of wipe your hands and take your hands off it and let it do its work and compound. That's the hard part, though, is not meddling. And particularly during a period like the last 15 years, where the S&P and U.S. stocks have just been romping and stomping. Both Buffett and Munger have a great quote where they're like, it's not fear and greed that drive markets, it's envy. And there's nothing worse than seeing your neighbor make a ton of money on NVIDIA or trading some sort of hot stock off Reddit, and you not. And so being able to keep it all together with a plan, you know, quoting Bogle, is really the key to it all.
But when I look at it, and you kind of flicked at it right now, the Standard & Poor's 500 index, the most representative index of the United States economy, five a cross section, I mean, industrials, gold, finance, obviously tech. Can you build a better mousetrap than that in simple terms? Because I think it is flawed, both at the turn of the century, because of its market capitalization bias. You seem to get the likes of Cisco and Microsoft and all of them, which in your investing coming of age dominated that market and then proceeded to have its worst decade to begin this century since the Great Depression. And we're kind of at that inflection point maybe as well right now, where tech names, you mentioned something like the Magnificent Seven, NVIDIA, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, these seven or eight names dominate something like 30% of the index. So you unwittingly, as kind of mom and pop investor, caveat emptor, buying a lopsided tech fund.
There's a couple ways we can go with this. But first, listeners, if you put all your money in U.S. stocks, pat yourself on the back, drink a glass of champagne, and really celebrate, because since 2009, U.S. stocks have done about 15% compounded, just a monster number. And is that normal?
Historically, no. Isn't that closer to 9.2, 10%?
Yeah. 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 In fact, there's only been four periods in history where U.S. stocks have compounded at 15% for a decade or longer. The funny thing is they all have names. So there was the Roaring 20s of 100 years ago. There was the Nifty 50s. There was the internet bubble, which I referenced in the beginning of this. And then, of course, this recent meme stock, COVID, whatever you want to call it, period. And so it's not that it's never happened before. It's normal. Normal stock market returns are extreme. You know, they're all over the place. But it's not something you can extrapolate forever. And then the downside is, if you look at what came after those periods, they also have names. There was the Great Depression, the inflationary 70s, and then the internet bubble.
Death of equities.
Burst.
Don't forget death of equities, son.
Right. And then the global financial crisis. It doesn't mean something bad has to happen after this period. It just means extrapolating 15% returns forever into the future is probably not the best baseline expectations to work from. You mentioned, you know, market cap investing. So investing in the S&P. And look, if you're going to do it like Buffett says, 20, 30, 40 years from now, it's probably fine. The big challenge and the Achilles heel of market cap investing is what you just mentioned. If you were to most listeners, if you say, hey, how are these companies weighted? You say, well, it's probably the biggest ones, the Apple, the Amazons of the world. And that's true. But only biggest based on market capitalization, which is just the share price times the number of shares outstanding. So there's no tether to actual earnings or sales or fundamentals. And so the problem when things go a little nutty to the upside is you put most of your money in most of the stocks that have gone up the most. And historically speaking, that becomes a problem when things are totally nuts. Now, I don't think we're in a bubble. It's just, you could say U.S. stocks, broadly speaking, are expensive. So expectations should probably be a little bit more muted. Simple ways to avoid that is you could do things like equal weight the portfolio. You could weight based on something like valuation. We do shareholder yield, which includes dividends and buybacks, little things like that to kind of cut that market cap weight.
And this is not exotic fare anymore. There are all sorts of ETFs that represent this. Low-cost ETFs. There used to be high-cost, very illiquid ETFs, and you'd have to go through some, you know, back alley to kind of buy them 20 years ago. But now it's really all out there. You can slice and dice to your heart's content, but also it's perilous.
And then there's an extension to that. So the first part is we say, look, U.S. stocks, there's a particular opportunity and value and high quality strategies right now. Value on average has done very poorly versus the market cap weight over the past 15 years.
Define again for our listenership value. I mean, what's cheap?
Well, it's like,
what's cheap and unloved?
It's like saying, you know, dog, right? There's beagles and schnauzers and American bulldogs. They're all very different, of course, golden retrievers. So value means a lot of different things. But on average, when you say something like value, it's half of it is you're saying, hey, I'm buying what's cheap on average. So something like a price to earnings ratio, but it's also, it's what you're avoiding, which is the really expensive. So the things that are trading at 100 times sales or revenue, on and on. And so really just tilting towards a Buffett style investing strategy we think has a lot of merit. And that's within the US. And then, of course, you look abroad, and broadly speaking, foreign investors have had the same struggles as U.S. People in the who have invested in the U.S. other than market cap weighted for the past 15 years. So foreign and emerging markets have underperformed, and they, on average, are also much cheaper
than the U.S. Correct me if I'm mistaken, but in that fateful first decade of this century, 2000 to 2009, following the stock market bubble, and stocks here bottomed, was it March of 2009, where all these articles were about a generation of investors have been flushed out. And yet that was perfect timing. Indeed, I'll never stop telling people that I was profiling Jack Bogle for Business Week, and I was on a train with him to DC for a conference. And, you know, he's working on he has his heart transplant. He's really frail. And he's telling me that it was the inverse of what he felt in March of 2000, that when he wanted to go all bonds, that he thought that it was such an irrational sell-off that it could be a generational low for people. But I step back from that, and I remember that first decade, 2000 to 2009, value was vindicated. International did really well. It was a gangbusters decade for emerging markets. We heard about the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China. Can you imagine that? Somebody actually touting Russia and Brazil. And the S&P, again, had its worst decade since the Great Depression. I mean, it just seems to be mean reversion. After euphoria, you're going to shoot the other way around. But we've now been saying this about international for 15 years, and it's like waiting for Godot. You know, just has not caught up. It's been a dead asset class.
You've touched on a lot of great points in here. The first being is these regimes can last a lot longer than the time horizons we want them to work on. Investors want certainty. They want it to happen now. And as we know, things can go crazier for a really long time. I mean, my favorite example, of course, is Japan. Japanese equities just hit a new high for the first time in 30 years, right? So they had the biggest bubble we've ever seen in the 1980s. Japan was taking over the world at that period, but their stock market got to the highest valuation levels we've ever seen in markets and hit a P/E ratio, a long-term P/E ratio of almost 100. So to put that in perspective, the U.S. only hit about half of that during the internet bubble. And on average, most countries tend to hang out around sort of 17 to 22, which is where most countries are today. Now, the U.S. is up around 35, so it's a higher than the rest.
And it took the Nikkei 35 years, a true lost era, a third of a century, just to revisit its nominal high.
And it's funny because the sentiment on investing in Japan has changed. Japan actually looks great. You know, Buffett, who we've mentioned, has been spending a lot of frequent flyer miles heading over to Tokyo and buying some Japanese companies. And we certainly find a lot of opportunity there. But particularly on the Jack Bogle comment, where March of 2009, if you look at the sentiment studies, the AAII, we love to reference, American Association of Individual Investors, has been doing this for over 50 years. They ask investors, are they bullish or are they bearish on the stock market? The single most bullish reading in the history of the study was December 1999, the literal worst month ever to invest in stocks in my entire lifetime. And you know where this is going. When were people most bearish? March of 2009. And so the amount of people that said to me, Meb, I sold all my investments, I couldn't take it anymore, and I never got back in. I heard that in 2010, 2014, all the way up years and years after, which goes back to this whole key of having an investing plan, trying to stick with it, and then not let the emotions creep in, which is, of course, the hardest part.
Meb, I got to share my anecdote, my shoeshine anecdote from December of 2009. I was working in the brokerage division at Goldman Sachs and meeting with a colleague, and we went to Shunli, was this Chinese restaurant in Midtown, Shunli East, that was famous for its 24-hour clay pot chicken. You had to call in advance. And so we called it in, and we were really psyched, and we had a great lunch. Again, it's December of 1999. There was a stock trading cabbie, a Brazilian guy and everything. And then we're ready to pay, and he gives us our check, the waiter, and I put in the card. He goes a couple of paces, and he starts laughing, and he comes back, and he asks us something I tried to understand, I couldn't understand. And I said, it says American Express on it. This is American Express. Go run it, right? He goes, he says it again, and then he walks about 8 paces and then comes back. He didn't run my card, and it says American Express on the thing. I'm paying with the corporate card, so I summon the maitre d' and the tux at the front. He comes over. They huddle. And I'm looking at them with my colleague, and then he comes to us, and he says, in his deep accent, he wants to know what you think of the Qualcomm stock. And that actually happened to me. And, you know, at the turn of the century. And if ever there was a cue, kind of everybody talking about this, Manhattan was lit. I had relatives I didn't even know about, Iranian relatives calling me and asking me about the market. I mean, talk about a contraindicator where it was really the opposite of that in March of 2009. I can't tell you that a lot of people talk to me about the stock market right now. Occasionally in Florida, I'm accosted by a crypto bro where people are talking about the property market there, but we certainly haven't hit that cocktail party level of froth.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because Bogle is the most well-respected investor that promotes buy and hold style investing. And it's a surprise to most listeners that he also, however, wrote a famous paper in the 90s that kind of deconstructs expectations for future stock market returns. And so Vanguard often puts out this quarterly piece saying, hey, look, we expect, you know, future U.S. stock returns to be below average going forward. And there's a video of Buffett where Bogle, where he's talking about asset allocation. And he says, look, you know, when things go crazy one way or the other, it's okay to over rebalance in one direction or not. So if you're a 60-40 investor, you know, and you're rebalancing back to target in 99, he's like, hey, maybe you go 50-50 or 40-60. I forget exactly what he said. Now, he wasn't talking about going 100-0 or 0-100, which is what most people want to do, but basically sort of trimming at the edges, trying to get lean into the headwinds and vice versa and for opportunity. And I think it's a myth that people always say that he's, you know, hates market timing. And so it's really more of a fundamental base leaning against the sentiment and euphoria and those type of periods too.
Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad. Joining us from SoCal, my guest is Meb Faber. He is co-founder and chief investment officer of Cambria Investment Management. He's authored several books. He is all over the LinkedIns and Twitters. I would think of him as a investing in markets thought leader. What was it, the Content Farm, also the email that I get from you?
The Idea Farm.
The Idea
once
Farm.
A week on
Sorry,
Sunday.
Not the Content
and
Farm.
It's free.
That sounds terrible. It's great. And you're a great collector, and we're going to get to this in the second half of the show, kind of how Meb built it. But I got to ask you, going back to Finance 101, and what is it, the efficient frontier? And again, we want to get out of the weeds. We don't want to be in Wonkistan for our listeners. But I was always under the impression that the only free lunch you could get in investing, if you could do it theoretically, if you could buy a little bit of every asset on the planet, including the S&P 500, small caps, gold miners, Peruvian alpacas, Haas avocados in Mexico, a chicken farm in frontier Tanzania, all of those things. If it was possible to find somebody for you to do that cost effectively, and you own a little bit of all those things, and things would zig when others are zagging, that is the only risk-adjusted kind of free lunch you'll ever get. Are we closer to being able to achieve that now that you have your choice of just all of these exchange-traded funds out there? Many firms aren't even charging commission for them. And you don't sand down your returns by buying a ton of ETFs. I understand that you've been out there looking for this elusive all-in-one way of getting exposure to the world without, you know, killing yourself with costs.
So it's the best time to be an investor. Like you mentioned, you can invest in a global portfolio of tax-efficient ETFs with no commission for essentially no cost. It's like 0.03%. That's incredible. That's amazing. Now, it's also one of the hardest times to be an investor because you have unlimited amount of information, including unlimited choice of 10,000 plus funds out there and the allure and seduction of all the funds that are selling the sizzle, of course. But I think coming up with a multi-layered plan, and here's what we tell people. We say, first of all, if you ask investors if they have a written investing plan, 90% say they don't. So, right, it can be a note card, doesn't have to be more than a page, a couple bullet points. Here's what I'm going to do. You mentioned the global market portfolio, fantastic starting point, which is essentially half stocks, half bonds, half US, half foreign. And that's actually a pretty hard portfolio to beat. We wrote about a bunch of asset allocation portfolios in a free book called Global Asset Allocation, which you can download online, that looks at a bunch of the strategies. And the conclusion, if you're doing buy and hold, was that as long as you have some of the main ingredients, and the main ingredients are global stocks, global bonds, global real assets, the exact percentages don't matter that much. And people obsess over the percentage. Should I buy gold? Should I not? What's the Fed doing? How much should I have in stocks, US foreign? All the things that we like to talk about. But in reality is, as long as you have the main ingredients, you usually end up in a pretty great place. The problems come when you start to muck around with these emotionally at the wrong times. You pay really high fees on the portfolio. That's a drag, on and on. And that's the base case from which to start with. And then the question is, can I improve upon that from there? And we think so. But on average, that'll get you ahead of probably 90% of not just individual investors, but institutions too. We wrote a long post recently about should most of these big institutions like CalPERS, which is a $500 billion plus institution, Bridgewater, you know, who has arguably the brightest minds of any hedge fund, one of the largest hedge funds in the world, you can basically replicate their portfolios with some ETFs and low cost. And that's amazing. So I think getting all that to work and letting that compound is like the key first step. And that gets you 90% of the way there. And then there's some things you can do to add on, we think, on top of that. That's really the beginning that most people, you know, don't even get that far. It's when you talk to most people, they say, you know, how'd you get to this portfolio? It's, well, you know, I bought a handful of these funds and I'm just going to see how it goes. I'm just going to wing it, you know, which if anyone's ever been on a diet or had an exercise plan after New Year's, you know, not having a plan is a big problem when you go for that muffin with your morning coffee.
Oh, yeah, I know it. You know, the home bias has been written about. You and others, Ben Carlson, have posited on it. I think about the conversations with the late Jack Bogle, you know, the modern founder of the Modern Index Fund, and he's associated with Vanguard, clearly, but he was kind of dismissive of international investing. Why do you need that? I'm sure you've heard this a lot when the Standard & Poor's 500, you think about Coca-Cola, Caterpillar, roughly derives, what, half of its sales abroad. Why not get it through United States reporting requirements and transparency, as opposed to having to go and buy, you know, a European developed index fund, an emerging markets fund, which, you know, emerging markets, for example, should South Korea be an emerging market in it? Israel is a developed market. I mean, how are we slicing and dicing these things? Does it matter in the end?
It's funny because Vanguard actually was always a bit at odds with Bogle on this topic, but Jack famously would stand his ground. There's a couple parts we love to say to this. And the first is the history is known, but future is uncertain. And so if you go back 100 years, 120 years to 1900, and we were chatting, you know, over some tea and talking about the future millennium, I don't know that U.S. going from essentially emerging to then developed market to being the number that the best, biggest economy in the world was a guaranteed outcome, right? I think people said, well, you know, I might also bet on Argentina. You know, maybe we'll bet on XYZ country. But it's also funny because if you look back to 1900, U.S. wasn't the best performing market. Tiny South Africa and Australia were better, but no one says put all your money in Australia or South Africa. But the international comment is interesting because if you ask, so let's call it, there's 45-ish developed and emerging countries included in the main indices. And if you were to ask probably 44 of those if global diversification is a good idea, they would say yes, absolutely. It was crazy to put all my money in Greek stocks or Brazilian stocks or Russian stocks or Chinese stocks, on and on. I'm so glad I diversified globally, right? It's really only been the U.S. and it's only been in this period. And so, you know, you hit the nail on the head when you went back to 2000 and said the U.S. got creamed by just about everything in the prior decade. Here's a fun stat. So U.S. beat everything in the past decade. 2000-2010, it was the inverse, right? The U.S. Beat, the equal weight or GDP weight of the world again in the 90s. And before that, you have to go back to, the 1910s for the U.S. to have outperformed per decade the global equal weight or GDP weight. And so looking at, there's a great quote from the late Peter Bernstein, who said, I view diversification not only as a survival strategy, but as an aggressive strategy because the next windfall might come from a surprising place. Meaning, you don't know if over the next 3, 5, 10 years, if it's gonna be UK stocks or Japanese stocks or stocks in Singapore, like who knows? India is having an amazing run right now. And so by diversifying globally, you hedge your bets. And so even if you do the global market portfolio, like you're talking about, so just in U.S. stocks, you have 60% in the U.S. Now, no one does in the U.S. They put 80-90% in, or 100. But even if you do 60%, that's 10 times as much as any other country. It's not double or triple. It's 10 times as much. And so go ahead and have that huge overweight.
But I mean, is there an American exceptionalism about that? I mean, certainly Germany's exporters, they export a lot of their wares to us. We've had Tom Gaynor on the show from your alma mater, and he stumped me. He goes, Honda, is that an American company or a Japanese company?
Yeah.
I mean, where does it derive its sales?
So,
and I had to think about that, you know?
One of the main reasons we hear people say they should invest only in U.S. is U.S. gets 40% of its revenue from abroad. And so they say, therefore, I'm diversified. And I say, do you know where the U.S. ranks on developed countries as percentage of sales from outside the country? I said, it ranks last. So if you're in this world of intertwined globalization where a company could be located in the U.K. but have zero sales there, the domicile and borders are becoming increasingly meaningless. And if that's true, then you should really look everywhere and not just in the US, which tends to be a lot more expensive than the rest of the world. Here, let me give you an example. So we run these three shareholder yield ETFs. And one of the criticisms in the US is that people say, hey, Meb, you run this value strategy, it's missing out on the tech stocks. Therefore, you guys have missed out. And I say, well, hold on a second. I say, you know, we held Apple for almost a decade in this fund. I said, but in general, it has a huge underweight to tech stocks currently. But I said, that's only in the US. In emerging markets, tech stocks are the number one allocation to this value strategy. In fact, the largest holding in this emerging market fund is a tech stock that's had better performance than Nvidia over the past year. I say, how many times have you heard this company's name on CNBC or on Twitter? Zero. It's Nvidia, Nvidia, Nvidia all day long. But, you know, that's part of the focus. That eventually changes. Historically, it's a coin flip between US and foreign in any given year outperformance. But this period has been unique. Cliff, who you mentioned on the podcast, you know, said, look, over the last 30 years, the vast majority of the returns of US, you know, over foreign has been multiple expansion, meaning the US has gotten more expensive. Yes, it has had better fundamentals, but it's also a lot to do with the fact that people are willing to pay a lot more. 2009, you could have bought US stocks for, you know, like a 11 times earnings, you know, so it's not that they're always expensive. It's just, it's this moment in time right now.
Darkest before the dawn. Please do stay with us. Full Disclosure Podcast to NPR, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all of the fine podcatchers. They're all in one place at link fulldradio.com. Again, fulldradio.com. Please subscribe, rate us, tell your friends, your mother-in-law, your high school pals. It's all there on the socials at handle fulldradio, LinkedIn, Twitter X, MySpace, you name it. And my DMs are always open. If you're just joining us, my guest is Meb Faber. He's co-founder and chief investment officer of Cambria Investment Management. I like to call him an investing luminary. I mean, you're a content creator, you're an investor, you're a surfer, you're an indispensable resource on LinkedIn. I love these hybrid personalities on the show because you can't just pinpoint them. I mean, to a certain mind, you're kind of a smart money investor. To another, you're a podcaster or a blogger, but it's just catnip for me to have you on the show. You know, you talk about multiple expansion. I see this as a Rorschach. Before I get into your story, I want to discuss Chipotle, not as a stock recommendation or anything, but as a kind of a barometer or metaphor for you look at the stock, you look at it as having a 50-for-1 split, you look at the pricing power in this period of inflation and pain for restaurants with labor costs and food costs. I walk into a Chipotle, I can't get out without, you know, shelling out $15 or $16. And it always makes me think, is this a perfect example of corporations having pricing power in an inflationary period where they, you know, you can participate in that pricing power by owning the stock? I mean, it's had gangbusters performance. I think the market cap is $80 or $85 billion. McDonald's spun it off back in 2006. I wonder if I regret that, but it's always... That's the way my mind works. When I go in there and I get a smaller burrito than planned and I pay, you know, 50% more than what my ticket was 5 years ago, what say you?
So you're making me hungry. All this talk about lunch. We have great tacos here in LA. But it's always surprising, I think, to people if you look at stock performance and what everyone's all hot and bothered about. You know, everyone's talking about Nvidia. But one of my favorite charts is looking back to the Domino's versus Google IPO, and Domino's has been a better performing stock. If you look at Nvidia over the past handful of years, there's some no-name stocks like Dillard's and Abercrombie and Fitch. These are stores out of like the 90s in my head, you know, like going to the mall. I didn't even know you think these companies are still around, but they've had equally as good of performance as some of the best performing tech companies. So you can always find interesting companies everywhere. You mentioned inflation though, and inflation historically has been the biggest problem for equity investors. Now, usually when times are mellow, so let's call it that 2-4% inflation, investors are feeling warm and fuzzy, prices are consistent, but particularly at 4 and above is a dark place for most investors. And what you see historically over the past 100 plus years, not just in the US but abroad, is that people are unwilling to pay as much for stocks when inflation is high and uncertain. And there's a lot of reasons for that. So, certainly companies that can pass along cost to consumers, that can raise their cash flows to keep up with inflationary times, should do better, that have pricing power. You know, I'm willing to pay a lot for that guac and chips at Chipotle. So it's easier for them to succeed. But if inflation does stay high, it's scary because the average multiple that people are willing to pay on stocks historically north of 4% inflation is about half of where it is today. And
I mean, at a very basic level for listeners, the longer you could get savings or CD accounts for something that seems chunky and you don't have to take an above average risk in equities, I mean, even though you quote them in real terms and a lot of people think nominally, if I can get a 5% CD, if I could get 5% on cash, why am I messing around in a stock market that's pricier than usual?
I think that's a reasonable question that people ask themselves. And, you know, a similar question too is if you can get 5-ish and change in T-bills, why take any risk in the fixed income market for corporate bonds or high yield or emerging or all these other types of bonds that may not yield more? And so we actually just wrote a recent paper called T-bills and chill most of the time, where we said, historically speaking, like a value investor in US stocks, yes, you buy cheap stocks, avoid the expensive. With bonds and this huge universe of bonds, it also makes sense to focus on the ones that are good values versus expensive. And the way you think about it in my mind is simply the yield. You know, so if someone comes and offers you junk bonds at 5%, you're like, well, why would I do that? I can just get T-bills at 5%. But if they came back tomorrow and the next day said, well, okay, I changed my mind. What about 12%? You say, okay, well, maybe that's worth the margin of safety baked in on that yield. And so the tough part right now is we have this really long period where the yield curve, meaning these longer term bonds like 10-year, 30-year, but also the corporate bonds, don't yield as much as they probably should, in our opinion. And so you just kind of paid to wait, hang out in T-bills and chill for a bit while the rest of the curve, either T-bill yields need to come down or everything else, the yields need to go up, or both, for it to sort of normalize relative to history.
Let's talk about you, Meb, as promised. Tell me when you graduated from UVA. You were an engineer, you were a double major?
Spring of 2000. So going back to your stories, I had professors trading stocks in class. So I have PTSD from all the names back then, listeners, CMGI, Lucent Technologies,
Juniper.
There you go, Juniper. and it's fun to look back at some of those names because it's a great example of having to distinguish between the stock and the business, right? This is something I learned very quickly, where you could have an incredible business like Cisco that from 2000 to today has had phenomenal growth in earnings and revenue, all these types of metrics you would expect from a successful business. But the stock has really struggled. You only got back to even. I mean, it's like from the peak in 99, only a few of the stocks that were in the top 10 market cap are back to where they were even then, because they had so much valuation they had to work off. And so paying a lot for something, it's a great example that the business and the stock need to be separated. So anyway, I got caught with the bug in the late 90s. I was trading just about everything. And so I became a quant investor because I had all the behavioral biases. You know, I'm overconfident. I'll take more risk, as much risk as you'll give me if I don't have guardrails. So I've learned all the mistakes, but you know, that's part of the entry. And the best thing you can do as a young investor certainly is learn these when you're young and don't have much money.
And it's one of those things, I think, when recruiters were coming around in 99, you had to duck to not get a Wall Street job? I understand that you took a job in what, biotech research?
Yeah. So, you know, my plan was to go back for a PhD in biomedical engineering, which is what I was studying. And so I started actually doing grad school right down the road at Johns Hopkins, but I was working for a biotech mutual fund during the day. And it was just as much of a euphoric period in biotech stocks as it was in internet stocks. And I think, I don't know, the fund that I was working for eventually went down probably 80%, 90%, I'm not sure. But I had caught the bug, and this puzzle of investing markets certainly stumped me and still does today in many ways. But I was smitten and wanted to help figure it out. And, you know, much of those early lessons and scars are what formed a lot of the ideas that we base our strategies on today.
Did you have personal money at stake? I mean, you had a personal account.
Oh, sure.
And you had to take,
yeah, man.
You had to get
hosed.
Oh,
yeah. You know, I traded everything. And so I have so many stories. You know, we end my podcast with what's your most memorable investment? And most investors often, it's painful losses or dumb things they did at the time. I mean, I was trading options on biotech stocks back then, certainly blew up my account, trading a Strangle and Biogen. I did everything. I traded IPO lockups. I was short selling. I was, you know, the equivalent of day trading back then on E-Trade, and, you know, considered it tuition. And many of the mistakes you hopefully learn from, as opposed to making them again and again. And, you know, it informed a lot of what we do when we started Cambria. And fast forward to today, you know, we have $2.5 billion under management, 150,000 investors around the world, but it's all systematic. I'm trying to remove as much of this discretionary decision-making because let's be clear, I wasn't particularly good at it.
So 24 years removed from you having that, you know, moonlighting, platooning as a biotech research analyst. If I had told you then that you would have been this kind of investing thought leader, because we're going to get to the creator economy. I mean, who would have thought? You know, you're in SoCal, I'm in Central Virginia, where you were previously. We're on this 720p connection on Riverside with our nice, snazzy cardioid mics. A lot of people are working from home. I don't follow individual stocks anymore. I mean, I got hosed. I got my heart handed to me, if you will, in that very first, you know, couple of years coming out of 2000. I worked in the brokerage industry and I ate some of the IPO product and choked on it. But I wouldn't imagine that I'd be here. And, you know, these thousand points of light, these people that you encounter on LinkedIn who are such sub-specialists of this space, or a person knowing that they're launching an investing book. You know, Mary Childs has been on the show. She's like, I got to go on Meb's podcast, because there are a handful of people out there that have such great institutional investor mindshare. I think of you and I think of Tom Keene, right? So how did that journey then begin coming out of 2000?
Yeah, so next stop was San Francisco. Was working for a startup commodity trading advisor, which had offices in the Bay Area, but also in Lake Tahoe. And as mentioned, I was a skier, so I was certainly the first to volunteer to work out of that office. And a lot of the ideas we worked on there have been around. I mean, like most ideas in markets have been around for a long time. So we do value strategies. Look, that goes back to the time of Ben Graham, 100 years ago. But there's also trend following type of strategies, which we haven't really mentioned today. But that also goes back 100 years.
Jerry Parker, who's been a guest.
Jerry's the best. To the time of, you know, Dow theory 100 years ago, too. But trend following methodology, which we had started working on in the early 2000s, and replicating a lot of these idea of the turtles of Jerry and others. And so the commodity trading advisor eventually folded, as most startup entrepreneur ventures do. We often say the biggest compliment you can give someone in investing, but also entrepreneurship, is just simply that you survived. If you succeed and make a lot of money or alpha, that's gravy. But sticking around is a big compliment. And so those ideas informed a lot of the research that we do even today. And so I had moved to LA in 2005 to start Cambria, started managing money in 06, didn't start managing ETFs until 2013. And so we had started with separate accounts and private funds. And our calling card has always been research. So, you know, the writing bug was really what we started with from the get-go.
You know, it was always hard to make money in research, especially after the Elliott Spitzer crackdown. Again, this is ancient history. If you think about the stock research scandals at the beginning of the century, and WorldCom and Enron and the conflicted analysts. But to be paid for your analysis, to have somebody actually fork over institutional tranches of money to you, I had to imagine would even be very difficult in 2005, even though we're talking about an open architecture, ETF-based world where, you know, the best ideas could prevail. I don't even know how you go and raise money.
Well, I think we did it even dumber. So all of our research has always, for the most part, been free. So I think our first client came from an article I wrote as an op-ed in the LA Times, which is odd because I've never done that before or since. But we had started blogging. My first foray was actually an academic paper. A lot of that was out of necessity. We didn't have the money to hire a sales and marketing staff or run ads on the Super Bowl or all these other things. So really is like, hey, let's find our megaphone and platform. And so back then it was called blogging and academic papers and books. Today it's more YouTube and podcasts and other places, but we still give real world speeches and things like that. I'm doing one tomorrow down in Orange County. But really, you know, the internet has been a great accelerant for us. Now it's also has its downsides. If you say something dumb on Twitter, you know, you're going to hear it pretty quickly. But to me, that's a great thing. The whole academic paper route we used to go down, I mean, it would take a year to get feedback and approvals and eventually come, you know, all that stuff. Yeah. Now I can throw it up online and, you know, I get people telling me and I'm an idiot within 5 minutes. So it's been
the most, yeah. The most brutal peer review is called troll review, right? On X. Yeah.
But a lot of times it can be helpful. You know, so many ideas that we've had over the years have come from that feedback process and iteration. You know, our flagship sort of allocation strategy is informed by a lot of feedback we've gotten over the years that wouldn't have been feedback necessarily that I would have guessed ahead of time, which is, you know, you have this beautiful global asset allocation portfolio we've talked so much about today. And then on the far right side, the biggest Achilles heel of a asset allocation portfolio is the really bad times. Because when it hits the fan, like a 2008, 2009, it feels like the world's ending. Everything's going down at the same time. Ditto and during COVID. I mean, remember watching the futures at night, markets open down 7%, these type of events.
It's just that weightless feeling.
It's hard. Now, on the flip side, and it's highly correlated to what's going on in the economy and your own personal human capital often. And so it's a hard for everyone to just kind of say, okay, I'm nerves of steel. On the flip side, trend following is usually the yin to that yang sort of portfolio. It usually does great during times of crisis, but it looks worse in other periods when buy and hold is doing great. And so at my core, I would probably, if you made me decide, pick a trend following portfolio over a buy and hold one. But really the magic comes if you mix the two. And for us, that only came after years and years of talking to investors and the emotional and psychological struggles they had with either portfolio. And then I said, oh, well, why not just do both? You know, the sum of the parts is actually much greater than either alone. But that was the feedback from many years of writing and talking to not just individual investors, but professional ones as well.
Full disclosure, stay with us. When you set up shop almost 20 years ago, did you see anything like the great financial crisis coming down the pike? I mean, I always comment that you could go back and look at Federal Open Market Committee minutes from early 2007. And these were like dinosaurs amid that, you know, great asteroid. They were completely oblivious to it. They commented on some weakness in the housing market, but that it was regional and pockets of softness, but certainly nothing systemic. And then suddenly we have this self-fulfilling crisis. I believe when the market did hit its low in March of 2009, it was at 1996 levels in inflation-adjusted terms. I mean, we went within a matter of, what, 8-9 years from the euphoria of Y2K to kind of just this overwrought world's going to end in 2009.
My favorite chart of investing is the long-term chart of U.S. stocks, and then it overlays on every year, whatever the crisis was that year. So
Cuban Missile Crisis,
Pearl
Vietnam,
Harbor, yeah. On and on, you know, and it goes to show just how many terrible things you have to live through, and yet you compound your money at 10% a year and eventually become extremely rich. The beauty of 10% a year, 25 years you 10x, and in 50 years you 100x. So 10 grand becomes a million, which is amazing, right? But you have to close your eyes, hold your nose. And I think that's obviously the hard part of all of this. You know, and I think looking at my favorite investing book, Triumph of the Optimist, which has history of stock markets, not just in the US, but globally for the past 120 years, you look at things and say, okay, let this set my expectations of what can and has happened. So I understand that, yes, stocks will maybe do 8-9%, but there's periods where they're probably going to go down by half. And there's periods, worst case, in any individual country where it's not half, it's 80-100%. And you have times where entire stock markets have shut down. And even in the US, sure, you know, it's 80 plus. So, and then you look at these periods in history, how long can one asset go underperforming? How long can, you know, this happen with bonds and bills, on and on. So you study the history and come up with your expectations. And even then have the humor to realize that the future is even going to be more uncertain and different than the past, but it's already weirder than most people would expect. So when you say, do you think like you would see is something like an 08-09, you know, my reply is always like, I expect normal market returns are extreme. That's a Fisher quote, but like, I don't expect, you're not going to see 8% a year, right? You're going to see up 20, flat, minus 10, up 4, up 40, you know, these type of returns that are just all over the place. Most people want that steady line, but that's not the play.
And these are table stakes. It's the cost of admission to the markets. And we've been spoiled over the recent past with kind of risk on, and it's just been very quiet. And the pullbacks, the bear markets tend to be very short-lived, but that's really not how it's been historically.
Yeah. Like you mentioned, bear markets, volatility, that's the entrance fee, right? That's the cost of the movie ticket to get in to see the feature film. But diversifying, having a bunch of different stuff in your portfolio, you know, I think really helps soften that blow. I mean, if you look at 2024, gold's at an all-time high. Other things like that, there's markets that are all-time highs. Cocoa.
Hey, and you see cocoa, you see crazy things. Like you read this in the Wall Street Journal, people thinking they could arbitrage the gold tablets at Costco, being unable to sell them, right? When it becomes a punter's market, as the economist would say, like, oh, I could get the 100,000 credit card points and turn around and flip them to someone else, when you realize that nobody's going to pay you par value for your gold. You know, this is when I start to get calls from relatives I didn't know I had asking me about gold.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And look, like every asset class is great sometimes and terrible other times. It doesn't matter what it is. I mean, bonds have absolutely gotten wrecked over the past few years, for example. Which is not surprising when you go from zero interest rates to five. But putting all these ingredients into the portfolio, my mom's a Southern cook from North Carolina. You know, she cooks by taste, not by exact recipe. And so as long as you have some global stocks, some global bonds, some global real assets, the cookies come out fine. It's when you ignore an entire category. I say, I didn't put any flour in this recipe, or I didn't put any butter or any chocolate chips. Well, then it's a problem. But as long as you have roughly the right ingredients, you're going to be okay.
Can you tell us how Cambria has grown over the last 15, 20 years, 10 years?
Yeah. Every investor out there, I do a lot of angel and startup investing. So I've invested in, I think, almost 400 companies at this point. And, you know, you go into this with the knowledge that most companies are going to fail. Most startups will eventually fail. Most companies, you know, go the way of the dodo and end up in the graveyard. And that's just capitalism and free markets, right? Which is great. That's the creative destruction we have and reason markets return what they do, not just in startups, but in public stocks too. And then you have these small percentage of companies that deliver so much of the return in these broad markets. So having looked at all these investments over history, realize that every entrepreneur who starts a company or a business has this naive optimism where they go into this saying, I realize most startups fail, but it's not going to be me, right? And so you have to have that belief. Otherwise, it's way too hard. Being an entrepreneur is like not drowning every day, right? You're just trying to keep your head above water. So for us, it was very much a, you know, overnight success, 15 years in the making, where it's two steps forward, one back, three forward, five back, you know? So it's just been clawing and scratching and surviving. And the investment business is certainly tough at subscale because you're competing with the Vanguards and BlackRocks that have trillion after their name. It's not billion, it's trillion. And they have the economies of scale. But once you start to get to size, and we like to think someone's going to stop calling us an emerging manager at some point, you can start to do some fun and innovative things. We just announced, for example, that all of our funds under 50 million, we're not going to charge expense ratio. which I haven't seen before. And so some of these things we can do as we grow up.
How do you make money?
We don't on those, but it's a scale business. So our largest fund is over $1 billion. And we see this as a platform. And over time, you know, my optimization goal is not to maximize my net worth at the expense of shareholders, but rather to, you know, keep the lights on. And if you look at the investing business and really the entire financial advisory space, you can kind of bucket the firms into two categories. One is how much can I charge and get away with it? And that's, in my mind, the Robin Hoods and shady brokers of years past. And the other category is the vanguards of the world, and we aspire to be in this category, is how little can we charge and still deliver an amazing product and keep the lights on and not go out of business, which is the hard part. So, you know, we're working on that as we scale, and hopefully there's more to come in the future too.
And I got to ask you, would you consider yourself a creator, a content creator, first and foremost? I mean, it's clearly one of the, you know, spokes in the hub and spoke model that is you in Cambria. But in terms of business acquisition, I see it's just part of your nature to publish and to post and to share, right?
Well, my most important objective when we have all these investors is they understand what's happening, right? So we're an active shop. So we're not, for the most part, we're trying to exist in this dark little corner of the investment space that's not competing with anyone else. We try to only launch funds that don't exist or that we think we can do much cheaper or better in quotes. But we want it to be based on academic research or research we've published. And so almost with every fund we launch, we publish a companion white paper, a book. We do podcasts on the topic so that people really understand what's happening. And then also to talk about very transparently when things are going poorly and funds and strategies that are doing poorly and why are they going poorly? Is it broken or is it just normal for funds to go a month, multiple years in a row of doing poorly versus a benchmark or, you know, on and on. We try to educate because investors, as we've seen over the years, one of the biggest seductions is chasing the hot offering. So whatever's performing great, chasing that, and then after it crashes and does poorly, selling it. So we want investors to be thoughtful in it for the long run and educated. And so most of the content is around those type of ideas. Hey, can we make sure that we're all on the same page? Because if you decide, hey, Meb, your funds are not for me, great. There's plenty of wonderful strategies out there that are totally fine, and we're not being judgmental about it. But if you want to be part of what we're doing, we want you to understand. And it's important to me, the average mutual fund manager owns $0 in their own fund, the portfolio manager, which is a crazy statistic. And so I put all my public assets into our funds and strategies and want to make sure that people understand I have skin in the game, you know, for better or worse. But we want to make sure people really get what we're doing. Because look, investing is hard, and it's even harder if your expectations don't meet reality of what's going on. And a lot of investors don't read past the headline. You know, they see the name of a fund and don't really dig into what they actually do, which we think is super important.
Meb, in closing, if I'm sitting next to you at a bat mitzvah or wedding, it's a Sunday night, I don't know, maybe even at a fish taco place in SoCal, I bump into you in your surfboard, and I tell you, what is the one thing in your journey that you wish people outside of your field would know? I mean, the old, you know, the hoary story of the sushi chef that tells you never have sushi on a Sunday night. What would that be in Meb Faberland?
I think the biggest part is coming up with an investing plan. Take out a blank piece of paper, listeners, and write down sort of your broad rules for your investing plan and implementation, and you'll be ahead of 90% of people out there. You can use that as your foundation. You can use it as your anchor from which to then deviate from, but at least you have a plan to work from. We're actually writing an article by the time this comes out. It should be out, called A Guide to Investing, that has some ideas here. And the companion piece called A Bear Market and Diversification. But really, to me, it's that. It's like you got to have a plan. And here's the analogy I give. Go walk out to your garage, listeners, if you have a garage. If you don't have a garage, walk out to your closet and take a look inside. And that's like your portfolio today. And there is no scenario that if you buy a new house, your house burns down, God forbid, there's a flood, everything in your garage gets taken out, that you say to your spouse, or, you know, you go and say, oh, you know what? I have to replace everything exactly like it was. I'm going to buy a used aquarium. on Craigslist. I need to buy one of those old fan-based exercise bikes because one day I'm going to start using it again. On and on, right? You would never do that, but that's the way people approach their portfolios, and there's a lot of junk and legacy positions in there. We call it mutual fund salad in the industry, where people just acquire all this junk. So take a Marie Kondo approach, clean it out, white piece of paper, write down your plan, write down your ideal portfolio, and then take an axe to these a lot of high fee tax efficient funds. And in the default in my mind, you know, taxes mindful, is to start over from a blank slate, because a lot of people get an emotional attachment to things they own, things they buy that they didn't own before, and they put a much higher value on it. And unfortunately, I think that works against everyone.
You were listening to Mep Faber, co-founder of Cambria Investment Management. He's written multiple books, which I think you give out for free. That's Invest with the House, Global Asset Allocation, Global Value, Shareholder Yield. Sir, it's a joy to have you on. It's a joy to follow your research. I'm grateful for it, and I hope you will come back on.
Thanks for having me, bud. Come see us in SoCal. We'll go grab some fish tacos you mentioned.
Thank you. Full disclosure, special thanks to Claire Morgan and Case Graham at Notterly. If you are listening to us on the radio, note that while we cut for broadcast length, the entirety of every interview is available on podcast. The link, please subscribe, is fulldradio.com. Again, fulldradio.com. And tell your friends and rate us. Follow along on all the socials at handle Full D Radio, LinkedIn, Twitter X, Instagram. Heck, if this was 2002, I'd burn CDs of this episode and hand them out on Times Square. Alas. A shout out to our listeners on Radio IQ, Virginia's NPR News headquarters. Message me if you would like to carry Full Disclosure on your air. My DMs are always open. And catch me every week on NPR's Here and Now. I'm Robin Farzad. Thank you for listening, and back with you next week. Thank you.